Against a mud wall in northern Uganda, a young man named Patrick sits with empty hands and an emptier stomach. Rebels have stolen his family, his home, his future. He owns nothing, no shoes, no food, no money. But beneath his fingers lies something everyone else has overlooked, clay-rich earth. Patrick begins to shape it, mixing in water, forming bricks. This simple act of creation transforms his life completely. The bricks become a business. The business employs his brother and neighbors. And eventually, Patrick builds his own home from the very bricks he once molded in desperation. This is where the journey begins, not with grand plans or venture capital, but with the raw materials at hand and the courage to see possibility where others see only dirt. Remember learning in Sunday school that the poor will always be with us? As a 5-year-old desperate to be good, those words haunted me. I pictured an endless line of suffering people, each taking what I gave only to circle back for more, a futile cycle where no amount of giving would ever be enough. This early conflict shaped everything, wanting desperately to help while fearing it was ultimately pointless. Charity marketing reinforced this helplessness with overwhelming images of starving children and statistics so massive they felt impossibly distant from my comfortable Pittsburgh suburb. I responded by giving, selling Kool-Aid, collecting for UNICEF, donating my allowance, but each act provided only fleeting satisfaction before the next plea for money arrived. San Francisco welcomed me with 2 suitcases and no plan. I moved into a crowded house on Sand Hill Road, unknowingly at the heart of Silicon Valley's venture capital world. Recent graduates filled every space. Closet rooms, a garage with a forbidden cat, a living room divided by sheets, and a backyard tent. I worked days at Stanford's Center for Social Innovation while serving evenings as a house mom at a shelter for teen mothers in East Palo Alto. The contrast was stark. Stanford measured social impact with sophisticated metrics, while the shelter ran on faith and community fundraisers. Then, in fall 2003, Dr. Muhammad Yunus gave a lecture that changed everything. The economics professor explained how in 1976, he discovered Bangladeshi furniture makers trapped in predatory lending cycles. With just $26 per person in interest-free loans, he helped them break free. This became Grameen Bank, pioneering modern microfinance for the unbankable poor. What inspired me most was Yunus's accessible approach. His breakthrough came from walking through villages, listening to people's needs, and taking direct action. This transformed my understanding. Poverty could be addressed one person at a time through small, concrete steps. Traveling through Tanzania with Richard Mzengo, I met Innocent at her mud and thatch home. After the traditional hand-washing ritual, she shared her first purchase from a $100 grant, sugar for our tea. This small luxury let her invite neighbors over with pride. I'd arrived thinking I knew what would help, but quickly realized I would have prioritized all wrong. Other entrepreneurs made equally unexpected choices. Padlocks for flimsy homes, non-functioning clocks as decorations, a single mattress for an entire family. These decisions taught me to let people choose what makes them feel empowered. Not one entrepreneur wanted handouts. They sought loans to maintain autonomy. A village enterprise grant of just $100 typically improved life for 15 household members, with ripple effects reaching entire communities. The entrepreneurs I met weren't victims awaiting rescue. They were capable business owners needing resources, not pity. Sitting across from a skeptical lawyer, I explained my vision of Americans lending money to Ugandans. He slammed his hand on the desk. "You can't just start lending money over the internet." Over several months, 40 lawyers saw only risk. Finally, Kieran Jane volunteered to help establish Kiva as a nonprofit, seeing potential where others saw danger. By spring 2005, after nearly a year of planning, Matt and I had hit a wall. It was time to act. I returned to Uganda with my friend Moses Onyango, recruiting 7 entrepreneurs needing small loans. At a dusty internet cafe, we uploaded their photos and stories to our bare-bones website. Then we emailed friends and family about our experiment, unable to promise repayment but hoping they'd lend $25. The response was immediate and overwhelming. People wanted to connect, to help, to be part of something meaningful. This validated everything we believed about human nature and our desire for genuine connection across borders. A year and a half after Kiva's launch, a corporate director offered $10 million, equal to everything we'd raised. The catch? They wanted to dump money into our system without actual lenders connecting with borrowers, contradicting our core mission. I declined. Taking that money would have meant turning away up to 400,000 individual lenders who could each make $25 loans. The representative was flabbergasted, but our mission was clear: connecting people through lending, not just moving money. Like Catherine the banana seller, who proudly proclaimed, "I am the bananas," and refused to sell other crops, saying no to misaligned opportunities means saying yes to your core commitments. Just before Kiva's launch, two entrepreneurs approached us about developing a microfinance venture together. Despite superficial similarities, our values didn't align. They used business-focused language about users and transactions, while we spoke of people and relationships. Out of fear, we initially partnered, sharing everything while they remained secretive. They gradually marginalized us, even offering my role to someone else. When we broke away in August 2005, we felt liberated. 2 months later, we launched Kiva independently and thrived while their venture eventually shut down. In spring 2007, amid Kiva's success, a New York Times mention, $10 million in loans, and an Oprah appearance, we faced our first major crisis. Shelby Clark, a Kiva fellow in Uganda, discovered our partner WITEP was a complete fraud. The leaders, including Moses Onyango, someone I'd considered a close friend and even our co-founder in Africa, had siphoned nearly $125,000 meant for borrowers. Despite fears of backlash, we chose complete transparency, drafting an honest email explaining what happened and offering refunds. The response shocked us. Instead of anger, lenders expressed gratitude for our honesty. Most even re-loaned their refunded money. This experience proved that transparency builds trust, even when revealing failures. Eventually, my own story required similar honesty. While professionally thriving, I was struggling personally. The intensity of startup life had taken a tremendous toll, and being married to my co-founder Matt made everything more complicated. Work problems followed us home, home conflicts bled into work, and boundaries disappeared completely. Rather than fight my way back in and harm the organization, I chose to leave, a double amputation that felt partly self-inflicted and partly beyond my control. After Kiva, I documented women entrepreneurs in developing markets for Stanford. I met remarkable women like Shona, a wheelchair designer in South Africa, and Zika, a hair salon mogul in Brazil. Despite diverse backgrounds, they shared creativity, optimism, and courage, each overcoming impossible obstacles with contagious entrepreneurial spirit. I reconnected with Stanford alumna Dana Moriello, and we discovered shared frustration. Securities laws severely restricted private enterprise investment. We created ProFounder to offer legal compliance tools for entrepreneurs seeking funding. Despite helping dozens of ventures and receiving press accolades, regulatory barriers blocked our vision. We chose to shut down and support the Jobs Act instead. On April 5, 2012, I sat in the White House Rose Garden as President Obama signed it into law, weeks after ProFounder closed and I'd given birth to twin boys. My definition of poverty has evolved beyond material lack to include believing we cannot use what we have to grow. True wealth means recognizing our capabilities and investing our most precious resource, time, in what matters most. The entrepreneurs in this book refused to be held back by what they lacked, focusing instead on action despite barriers. They've convinced me I too can live entrepreneurially, choosing action over paralysis. Start with what you have. The road appears when you take the first step.